So now we've got Krithika Srinivasan, I hope I pronounced that right. She worked as a lecturer in the Department of Geography at the University of Exeter and Durham University before moving to Edinburgh. She has a PhD from King's College London and MA from the Tata Institute of Social Sciences.
This is too long.
Oh, sorry, do you not want me to read all of that? Where she was subsequently employed as a researcher. Her years there have had a particularly formative influence on her work. Her research interests.
They can look up my webpage,
okay.
Okay. Okay, I forgot what I wanted to say. So I'm going to jump straight in and ask you to kind of think about the times that we live in. As some speakers have already mentioned, we live in times that have come to be called the Anthropocene because of the kind of devastating impacts of human lifestyles on the planet and the other creatures that we share the planet with. But at the same time, we also live in times of what I like to call more than human social change, you know, times where we are actively trying to think about the ethics and ethics of our relationships with the other creatures that live on the planet. And two arenas in which you see such social change most markedly are the arenas of environmentalism and animal protection. In this paper, I'm interested in thinking about what happens when these two trajectories intersect. So when harmful human ways of being intersect with the kind of desire to ethically improve human interactions with non-human life. So what is it that happens when these two things come together? In order to do that, I work with empirical materials on Oliver Ridley total conservation in Orissa and India. And I also use the social theorist Foucault's work on biopower and epistemes as an analytical lens. In thinking about these things, I also intervene in some of the debates in conservation policy, science, and philosophy on the relationship between individuals and collectives or assemblages, and the kind of debates between ecocentrism and biocentrism, which the first keynote speaker was also talking about, and I think one of the other speakers in the next panel is going to be discussing. So that's basically what I'm going to be trying and doing in this paper. And what I want to do is to develop an argument about why it is that ecocentrism has prevailed as a value in conservation. So why is it that that has continued to remain entrenched as a conservation ethic, as a value system, despite the kind of troubling implications that it has for the very subject objects of conservationist care. So first, just a quick background on Oliver Ridley turtles. These are marine turtles. They live in the deep oceans, and they travel to the to coastal waters every year for mating and nesting on very selected beaches in different parts of the world. They're classified as vulnerable to extinction by the IUCN. Now, Oliver Ridley turtles nest solitarily, but they also nest in mass nesting events called aribaras. And there's a picture of an aribara here, where thousands of turtles come ashore at the same time over a short period of a few days to lay eggs. So, and these are quite magnificent spectacles, and aribara sites are also quite rare, and as such they become the focus of conservation action simply because they hold a large nesting populations together. So in India, in the state of Orissa, which is on the eastern coast of India, you find three aribara sites at the Gahirmata beach and at the mouths of the Rishikulya and Devi rivers. Now, Oliver Ridley turtles in India, as in many other parts of the world, face several threats. They face related to human activities. They face threats related to mechanized fishing and incidental mortality in fishing nets, mechanized fishing nets, and also in trawlers. And they also face threats because of development activity, right from the destruction of nesting sites to artificial illumination to pollution caused by different kinds of human activities. And these human activities, development activities, have most recently taken the form of a port project, the Dhamra Port Project, which is now up and running, but which was initiated in the early 2000s. So on the one hand, in Orissa and India, you have all these threats that the All Indian Turtles face. But on the other hand, because of several decades of conservation action in the region, you also find that All Indian Turtles enjoy several protections. So they enjoy legal protections. So under the Indian Wildlife Protection Act, they are listed in Schedule 1, which basically forbids the intentional hunting of the turtles. The Gahir Mata nesting site was declared as a sanctuary in 1997, and that goes with a certain degree of protection, which I will discuss a bit later. The Orissa Marine Fisheries Regulation Act, which is not primarily a conservation tool. It's a tool meant to regulate fisheries so as to allow for sustainable fishing. But under the Act and its rules, you find that there are seasonal notifications issued during the nesting season in order to protect the turtles from mechanized fishing. In addition to these various policies, which again are the outcome of lobbying and advocacy by both local, national, and international conservation groups, what you also see is that IUCN, which is an international conservation organization, which you might many of you might be familiar with, entered into a partnership with the Dhamra Port Company, which is the port authorities themselves, in order to develop a program to mitigate the impacts of port-related activities, mainly dredging and lighting on the turtles. So these are the various kinds of threats and protections that are available and that are faced by the turtles. Now, while there are all these protections in place, at the same you find that these protections face a great deal of opposition, much like conservation measures in different parts of the world. And the kind of conflict that they create are conflicts that is often described in the social sciences as fortress conservation. So on the one hand, the fisheries regulations rules and the marine sanctuary have been opposed by local fishing unions and fishing communities on the grounds that they reduce fish catch and that they lead to harassment by forest officials, and that they're the outcome of, there's a quote from a fishing union leader there that, you know, it's all these foreign countries that don't want the Indian fishing industry to thrive, and therefore they are finding a way of stopping us from our regular activities. And some of these conflicts have, at various points, have gotten quite violent in terms of shootouts, in terms of suicides, and though there are more detailed inspection will show that there are multiple variables that come together to result in these conflicts, but there is significant opposition to the sanctuary and the fisheries regulation rules because of the impacts on the fishing community. With regard to the port project, before the IUCN port, Dhamra port collaboration, Greenpeace, which again is an organization that many of you might be familiar with, launched an anti-port campaign when the first project was first made, plans to develop the port were first made public. Now, it was a national campaign, and it invited opposition from not only the port authorities, but also from the state government and the national government. And at one point, the Orissa state government blacklisted Greenpeace, like the Indian government is trying to blacklist, blacklist Greenpeace. So they stopped. They basically issued an order saying that Greenpeace is not allowed to operate in our state, and Greenpeace representatives are not allowed to set foot into our territories. And so the argument here was that these environmental groups and conservationists are being anti-development, and that they're not allowing for regional socioeconomic development to take place. That because Orissa is, and the port in particular, was supposed to be a conduit for the mineral resources that are there, which central India is quite rich in, central and eastern India. And the Dhamra Port, which is a public-private partnership, was meant to be a way of both to import the resources required to extract mineral resources in central and eastern India, and also to export the resources so extracted. Okay, so on the one hand, you have these conflicts that take place over conservation in India, but on the other hand, you also have regularities. So what you find once you go and speak to people there is that on the one hand, there is this like broad consensus about the importance of protecting olive ridley turtles as a species. So everybody, right from the fishing union leaders, the port authorities, say that, yeah, that's important that, you know, turtles don't go extinct, it's important that we protect them, but just do it in a way that doesn't affect our interests. And this has been described by various social theorists, Arun Agarwal the most notably, as being the product of subjectification. So, you know, over a period of time, even actors who are not typically, who you wouldn't expect to be interested in environmental and conservation, environmental values, who wouldn't espouse environmental values and who wouldn't be interested in conservation, they start to internalize these norms because of the broader social context. And so this has been, so it's what some social scientists call the making of environmental subjects. So in one, it's you can explain some of this because of that. And you also find, like I already mentioned, the Dhamra port went on of their own volition to enter into a partnership with IUCN, for which they spent a significant amount of money to mitigate some of the activities, the impacts of port activities on the turtles. They didn't have to do it, but they did it on a voluntary basis. So you have these regularities among on the what you would think to be the anti-turtle camp or the anti-conservation camp. You find that this is that you find this kind of consensus about protecting turtles. But what I'm more interested in this paper is the consensus that you find among the conservation groups and the environmental groups about the importance of human interests, whether they be local livelihoods or whether it be broader socio-economic development. And in various reports that have been generated by conservation and environmental groups in that region, in interviews that were carried out with conservation actors in that area, and also through the activities of conservation groups working in the region, you find that there is this, these are all different quotes from some of the data that I put together. You find that there is this broad consensus about the importance of human interests among the conservation actors. And there's one, a few, some of the groups there, even conservation groups ran, they spent a significant portion of their annual budget on running livelihood development programs for fishing communities. So not just on actual conservation, but on working with fishing communities to help them with their livelihoods. So in what you have here is a situation in which conservation discourse and action, conservation practice at this stage is underpinned by two sets of normative objectives. So the one set of set of normative objectives are, you know, more than human, you know, what you would expect, that their norm there, the value that they want, their goal is to protect turtles, to protect non-human life. But you also find that conservation action is influenced by human-oriented normative objectives, which broadly, in this case, relates to the importance of not compromising human activities or not negatively affecting local livelihoods and regional socioeconomic development. Now, to think about these regularities in these otherwise conflicting camps and positions, I turn to Foucault's work on knowledge. Now, Foucault, in some of his early work, he looks at knowledge formations that are otherwise quite different, such as natural history, economics, and grammar, and he identifies some regularities that cut across these otherwise, you know, very different formations, which he then theorizes as the episteme. And his basic argument is that at any point in time in a culture's history, it is possible to identify, looking at, you know, different knowledge formations, it is possible to identify these regularities, which you can then think of as forming the limits and possibilities of what can be, what constitutes knowledge at a particular point in time. So, you know, knowledge, what counts as knowledge, what is accepted as knowledge, even if it might be from different disciplines, can be is very contingent. It's very particular. And you can think about this in terms of the episteme. So that's the basic idea behind Foucault's work on knowledge. Now, in the case of Orissa, I borrow Foucault's idea of episteme to think about the regularities that you see in these otherwise opposing camps in the debates around conservation, and theorizing these regularities, or, you know, basically referring to them in terms of the sustainability episteme. Now, sustainability is a word that you all must be familiar with, and it basically refers to to a balancing act, right? It's all about allowing human activities to continue in a certain way, but so as not to affect the environment or not to affect the non-human world so much that it compromises compromises human life. So the kind of norms that you see in that cut across the various positions in the debates around total conservation in Odisha, norms relating to human well-being, which is to do with local livelihoods and regional socioeconomic development, and norms relating to the importance of the survival of the olive ridley turtle as a species, in some ways map on to the kind of the twin norms that are embedded in sustainability discourse more broadly. Now, the basic argument that I want to make in this paper is that the competing norms that you find in the sustainability episteme and which influence conservation discourse and action in Odisha and also more broadly have the effect of rendering biopolitical conservation practice. What do I mean by that? Right? What do I mean by that conservation practice becomes biopolitical because of these competing, because of these incompatible epistemic norms? For that, I turn to another aspect of Foucault's work, which is his work on power. Now, Foucault's work on biopower basically says that power is expressed in forms that are different to the ways in which we normally think about power. We normally think about power as something that is wielded by through force, something that is negative in its articulation. So as is most, you know, as is in the power of the sovereign to chop off the head of his or her subjects if they don't listen to what he or she wants to say. So what Foucault says is that sovereign power is not the only way in which power is wielded. Power can also be positive in its expression, in its articulation. It can be focused on fostering life. It can be focused on governing life and regulating life for the well-being of life itself. So assuming I'm the queen, and I basically want us, all my subjects to be fit to go wage war for me, to go and colonize, I don't know, Sweden, I can do it in two ways. I can do it through sovereign power and say, all of you better go and, you know, you make sure that you exercise for at least 2 hours a day so that you're fit enough for my army. And if you don't, I'll chop off your heads. So that's sovereign power, the way in which we tend to think about power. Or I can do it another way, saying that you must exercise 2 hours every day, because if you do that, you will be healthy, which is good not only for yourself, but also for the population as a large, because we can protect our territory from invasions, and we can go and colonize Sweden so that we can get resources to develop our own population. So there are two ways in which I can get you to do the same thing. And it might be that exercising for 2 hours a day might not be good for you as an individual. It might suit some people. Other people, it might just make them get a heart attack and die, which isn't just good for me, because I don't want an army which has soldiers who, you know, are going to have a heart attack when they're out waging war. So you see, so that is what Foucault calls biopower. So it's all about, you know, so the way in which I get you to do this is to kind of tell you that it's good for you and it's good for the population. And there are two features of biopower, as Foucault describes it, that I use in this work. One is that biopower is focused on populations, on assemblages. It is focused on collections of things, of life. And secondly, biopower is characterized by the entanglement of harm and care. So biopower is always, biopolitical discourse is always in languages of care, but there are ways in which harm creeps in the exercise of biopower, which we will see how as we go along. So if we go back to conservation, we all know, and this is something that has been discussed widely, both here in this workshop and in the conservation ethics literature, that conservation is primarily about collectivities. It's about assemblages. It is about protecting species. It is about protecting ecosystems. It is about protecting populations, right? And this is something that is true of olive ridley turtle conservation in Odisha as well. And it's something that is seen across the world and across the globe. And to the extent that you find that forest department officials who are very much on the conservation campsite talk about how 10 to 15,000 deaths may not be, you know, anything significant because it may not affect the population. So conservationist care is always directed at the collectivity, at the assemblage. Now, the thing about a focus on the collectivity, on the assemblage, is that it's not necessarily bad in and of itself. As the keynote speaker said earlier today, that you do need to protect collectivities like habitats and ecosystems in order for individuals to flourish, whether they be individual people or whether they be individual turtles or other individual animals and plants. But a focus on collectives and assemblages in and of themselves can have also pernicious consequences. It can have negative impacts. And this you see in the exercise of biopolitical power, where individuals are harmed in the name of the care of the broader collectivity, the broader population, or the assemblage, which goes back to the example that I gave you earlier. So I'm happy for you to have a heart attack and die as long as it's good for the population as a whole, and I make you I tell you that it's good. So the care that is directed at the collective, at the assemblage, can often go along with harm at the level of the individual. So individuals lose moral and ethical significance in the exercise of biopower, and they can be set aside and they can be even sacrificed for the sake of the collectivity, for the assemblage. And this often is articulated in calculations of acceptable harm, which you see in different domains. Foucault talks about it in the context of food security and famines. But in the context of turtle conservation in Orissa, you have several such examples. So conservationists, for example, talk about an acceptable figure for turtle mortality, which is then manifest in things like turtle take allowances. So one of the conservation interventions that I mentioned earlier is to do with dredging related to port activities. And dredging basically involves scooping out the ocean floor near the coast so as to allow ships to come close enough to the harbor. And dredging, basically scooping out the ocean floor and dumping the material elsewhere, has the kind of consequences for marine life that you can well imagine. And with regard to turtles, the main problem is that turtles get sucked up through the dredger. So the conservation intervention that the IUCN Dhamra Port Partnership came up with was that of turtle deflectors, which are basically these things attached to the dredger drag head, which push turtles out of the way so that they wouldn't get sucked up with the ocean bed. But the thing about these turtle deflectors is that they're not as straightforward acts of care as they seem to be. Turtle deflectors go along with what are called turtle take allowances, which basically are calculations of how many turtles can be killed because of dredging before it becomes a harm per se. And this is not unique to Orissa. You find turtle take allowances used in different contexts in different parts of the world, with regard to fishing, for example, or with regard to other development activities. And so in Orissa, in the dredger, you have these observers who monitor the dredged material to see if there are turtle bodies that come up, because not all turtles are pushed out of the way. And then you have this kind of number for how many turtles can die before it becomes a problem. Turtle-friendly lighting was the other main conservation intervention that was introduced through this partnership, and it was to deal with the negative impacts of artificial illumination on turtles, which basically makes the hatchlings go landwards instead of seawards. And so the port was fitted with turtle-friendly lighting. But the thing about turtle-friendly lighting is that it's not actually friendly. It is just lighting that is of a wavelength that is less harmful than regular lighting of this kind. Turtle-friendly lighting also doesn't take into account the kind of effects of artificial illumination from secondary development associated with the port, because a port comes up, but then there are other things that come up around it. And turtle-friendly lighting doesn't really refer to, is not really relevant to all of that. Even the marine sanctuary, which is what you think to be an example of fortress conservation, is actually a closer look actually kind of reveals that it's not straightforward protection of that kind. So the marine sanctuary is operates by specifying what kind of boats and nets are allowed to operate at different parts, at different distances from the coast. And these decisions are made on the basis of turtle densities at different parts of the coast. And so with increasing distance from the coast, you find that different mechanized boats are permitted, and then after 20 kilometers from the coast, you find trawling is permitted. And the argument is that turtles are not present in high densities at these distances, and therefore the impacts will not be as as significant. But despite these calculations, you find that even though the sanctuary has been in place and these regulations have been in place since 1997 now, you find that more than 10,000 turtles are washed ashore. Dead turtles are washed ashore every year, and these are just the bodies that are washed ashore. And so it is believed that many more actually die because of getting trapped in fishing nets and in trawlers. But yeah, you just don't know. So this is a very conservative number here. So another kind of conservation intervention, which very beautifully exemplifies the entanglement of harm and care, is that of sustainable harvesting. Now, sustainable harvesting is not permitted in Orissa, but conservationists working in the region advocate very strongly for it on the grounds that it will provide local communities with an incentive to support protection of these turtles. And it is argued that the turtle population numbers are high enough to allow for the harvesting of turtle meat and eggs. And this is even though there is no demand for meat and eggs in that particular region. So it is to kind of create a demand so as to make turtles an economic commodity, which in turn is meant to gather local support for conservation. It's not specific to turtles. Again, sustainable harvesting is something that you see in conservation action across the world. Harm and care come together in much more subtle ways in spaces of conservation research. An example lies in that of tagging. So conservationists both in Orissa and across the world want to carry out research on various animals in order to find out how best they can protect them. And one way in which they do it is through tagging. As the pictures here show, tagging is pretty invasive. It causes a great deal of pain, it causes tearing, and it also results in an increased chance of being trapped in fishing nets. Tagging might seem quite obvious as a painful activity, but the entanglement of harm and care is much even more subtle in ecotourism activities such as turtle walks, and in conservation research activities such as population censuses. Now, you wouldn't think that going and counting turtles is going to harm them. But the thing to remember is that these animals come ashore in the darkest nights, usually moonless nights, because they want to avoid predators. And they come ashore to nest at a point when they're very vulnerable. And these turtles have no way of knowing that these conservationists and these people who are engaging in ecotourism in order to, generate funds for further conservation. These animals have no way of knowing that they don't. 2 minutes. That they don't intend harm. And so again, you have this kind of entanglement of harm and care in conservation activities in the area. As I've been saying, none of this is specific to Olive Ridley turtles or to Orissa. You see this in conservation action across the world. So it's one thing to say that conservation is infused with biopolitical practices, right? But I think the more interesting question is that why this space of care? Because conservation is primarily about caring for the non-human world. Why is it that the space of care is infused with such concepts and practices of harm? For that, I want to go back to what I discussed in terms of the sustainability episteme before, and the kind of conflicting norms that you find embedded in the sustainability episteme, which influence conservation discourse and action, right? And my basic argument is that win-win conservation that allows for the protection of non-human life while not seriously disrupting existing human ways of life is possible only if non-human life is conceptualized at the level of the assemblage. So it's only if we think of, and turtles in this case as a population, as a species, is it possible to care for them and also continue with the human activities that harm these turtles, right? It allows for fishing to go on, it allows for port construction to go on, it allows for conservation research, it allows for turtle walks, all activities that harm turtles, but then because they do not affect turtles as a species, because they do not affect turtles as a population, you still are doing good for the turtles, you're still caring for the turtles because your focus is entirely on the collector, your focus is entirely on the on the assemblage. So because these conflicting norms result in the kind of entrenchment of these collective ontologies in ecocentric values in conservation, because the moment you start thinking in biocentric terms, the moment you start thinking in terms of the well-being of the individual, win-win conservation that addresses these incompatible norms will become impossible, because there's no way you can have port construction and not affect at least one turtle or, you know, one fish. The argument here is that conservation ontologies and such as, you know, populations and species and ecosystems, they're not the kind of matters of fact that we often take them to be, but they serve a political function. And in this case, the political function of allowing for win-win conservation that addresses otherwise incompatible norms. And you know, one way this becomes very clear is in, like, it's very unlikely that these animals think of themselves in such collective terms, or even if they do, it is highly unlikely that they're willing to sacrifice their individual well-being and lives for the larger collective. So to just wind up, so Foucault talks about biopolitical power as something that emerges in times and spaces of change. He talks about it in the context of the shift from monarchy to other forms of state rule in Western Europe, but we can also use some of these ideas to think about other spaces of social change in today's world, and one of which is conservation, another of which is animal protection. And what always happens in times and spaces of social change is that the efforts to ethically improve relationships between self and the other are always embedded in ways of being that are harmful to the other. So social change does not appear in a vacuum. Yeah, that's basically it. And so I guess the Foucauldian antical lenses to kind of help think about what happens in these spaces of social change.